And good morning once again. Thanks for allowing us into your space. Now, Pete Portal is the author of a book called No Neutral Ground, and it really gives his account. This is of a journey that started in London and finds him on the Cape Flats in one of the most notorious suburbs where he started a ministry there. And he'll tell you the story. I don't want to tell the whole story, but it really looks at rehabilitating drug addicts and helping gang members find their way out of a very deadly lifestyle. So, Pete, thank you very much for your time. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Keno. Good to be here.
Wonderful, Pete. So let's talk about London. Let's start right at the beginning. What were you doing there, and you know, where was that tipping point that actually started this journey for you?
So I grew up in London and was a graduated university and was working in kids TV at CBBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, and you know, that was fine, sort of gunging parents and assembling giant pogo sticks for the live studio show, that sort of thing. But the summer prior to graduating university, I had been on a short-term, six-week trip to Cape Town, where we had worked with a local pastor who had actually come out of gang life himself and were visiting prisoners in Drakenstein Prison and were living in Bontyville and just getting to know the community, hearing stories of oppression and addiction. And those 6 weeks changed my life, irreversibly. So the allure of kids TV had less of a pull on me when I realized, you know, here's something I'd been exposed to in Cape Town. I couldn't get my head around the racial dynamics and inequality. That struck me immediately. And I just figured, maybe I've got a responsibility to respond to something that I've seen. We didn't achieve much of lasting worth in those 6 weeks. Of course, you know, we were young, naive British students. It was one of those classic volunteerism trips. But, you know, 11 years living in Cape Town now, I can look back and say, thank God that I was exposed to various things that moved me.
So where do you live in Cape Town?
So Sarah, my wife, and I live in Manenberg, just on the edge of Manenberg. And we've been here for the last 5-6 years living here.
You need to have good faith to make that particular leap. And the reason I say that, right, is because when we talk about Manenberg, all we hear in the media are people getting shot and all the negative things coming out of Manenberg. And hopefully this discussion will take us down a different journey, not ignoring the negative stuff, but also looking at some of the more beautiful things that do happen there. And I saw something on your Facebook page where you said there's something beautiful going on in Manenberg. It's kind of like what you would read about as a dream scenario in community organizing manuals, different stakeholders coming together to work towards a common good. I like the fact that you are painting another picture here, because I do think it's important to get a balanced picture as to what's happening in a community like this.
Absolutely. And I mean, what you're referring to is has been a beautiful generative solution to problems posed by COVID lockdown. And that is namely that in Manenberg, a high proportion of the workforce is in casual jobs, which means during lockdown, there's no safety net for, salaries, which means lots of people are hungry and anxious, impossible to social distance due to overcrowding here. But a group of friends in Manenberg and Kenilworth came together, started a community action network connection between the two areas. And so now there are 14 kitchens feeding up to 3,500 people a day, thanks to basically the collaboration and sharing of resources from Kenilworth to Manenberg. So it's been amazing. And, you know, the reason I find that so beautiful is because I think what we've seen in lockdown is a lot of high-profile relief efforts to give lots of food out and do this and do that and lots of selfies of feel-good you know, donors.
Yeah.
But what I see in this is actually a subversive relationship that has, I think, huge potential to weigh out last lockdown and even COVID and create bridges from suburbs to townships and back. And that, for me, is beautiful because it's what's the word, deconstructing the apartheid landscape and spatial history of Cape Town. And that is amazing.
So what's it like as a white dude living in Menenberg? What type of reception have you received there? I'm sure a lot of people, I mean, if you ask anybody, people who even were born on the Cape Flats, and you say to them, listen, you're now living wherever, and would you move back to, you know, would you go and live in Menenberg? I think by and large, 9 out of 10 people will tell you to go and fly something. So what has this experience been like for you?
Yeah, great question. It's, you know, it's worth saying it probably took about, oh, I don't know, a couple of years for people to realize, oh, okay, this guy's not actually going anywhere. The first question people would ask is, so when are you leaving? You know, because Menenberg's a community that, as I say, for the sort of hardcore do-gooder or even, you know, sort of evangelical missionary or something like that, which is a description we reject. We don't see ourselves as that at all. But it took a couple of years, I'd say, for people to see me walking the streets with local friends. And we would literally walk and we would pray. We would walk and pray, not talking to anyone, but just praying for the peace of Menenberg. And as we did that, people began to see us, and they would ask us, you know, "Wat macht ihr so?" And we'd just say, "Os looken, but this is all we're doing." About a year into that, I then moved in to a house in the middle of hard living gang territory, and welcomed a heroin addict who had become a dear friend to come and live with me. And you know, it just seemed to me that I can be a white guy commuting from the suburbs, doing my thing every day, handing out, you know, food and hugs and opinions and selfies, which does my head in, because, you know, to become a stakeholder in a community, to share the trauma and hopes of a community, you know, albeit, sure, in a slightly contrived way, in a sense that I'm never going to be of Menenberg in a way that someone who grew up here is. But my wife Sarah and I felt like, you know, both theologically and politically, moving into the neighborhood was the most congruent response we could come up with in response to the inequality and division in Cape Town.
So living in that area, and it's the construct of Cape Town, it's what happens, and it's really unfortunate. Some kids are lucky enough, some would argue, to escape and not be surrounded by some of the negative influences like the hard livings and some of the other gangs. But the fact is, a lot of young children are exposed to them. You also deal with, you know, people who are drug addicts, people who I would imagine are also linked to gangs. How do you assist someone like that, almost putting them on a different path without putting your own life in danger?
Well, I think danger is a relative term, firstly.
Sure.
You know, many of us drive cars. And I remember when I first got my driver's license, my granny pointing her finger at me and saying, remember, a car's a lethal weapon. And so, you know, every time we get in the car, there's an element of danger to it. I think, you know, we're aware of a lot of the dangers of working with gangsters and addicts.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. When we, you know, we open our home for a number of young men, 18 to 25 year olds in gangs or drugs or both, to come live with us. And we do it in a quiet corner of Menenberg because we don't want to do it on a particular gang's turf because that would be problematic during gang fights.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's, for example, a nod towards safety.
Sure.
But we're also aware that people say that the guys that we share our home and our life with belong in jail. But I think our conviction is that everybody actually belongs in family. And if you consider that you know, literally bar none, have grown up with no fathers, and the only role models being drug dealers and older gangsters. And if you bear in mind that when you take them out of the immediate reality of their gang brothers standing on the corner and all the bravado, a lot of the guys will lie here in bed their first night and cry themselves to sleep because they miss their mums. You know, they are struggling with continuous trauma. They're struggling with flashbacks, deep shame and guilt from what they've done. I don't think I've ever met a happy gangster. There's serious levels of depression. And so what they need is actually fathering. They need family. And they need a redemptive brotherhood, because we can't ask anybody to leave a gang unless we've got something better to offer them. And when you bear in mind that the reason people join gangs is essentially to belong and to feel safe, when you realize that, then you can actually construct something around belonging and safety that is a generative contradiction to the counterfeit brotherhoods that they spend their lives growing up in.
Now, it's one thing to give someone hope, and that's important. It's one thing to put a person on another path. Yes, it's important. But how do you make this sustainable? How do you intervene and make sure? And then maybe there's a story that can demonstrate how you've done it. I'm sure you've got a lot of stories to tell, but maybe there's one in particular that jumps out and says, you know, as a result of this intervention, this is where this particular person is today.
Yeah. Sustainability is a big one. I mean, you're looking at emotional sustainability, you're looking at financial sustainability, all these different things. One of the things that Sarah and I have come to realize is that we need to redefine what we mean by success. So, for example, people will often say, so how many guys have you helped get clean? And you go, well, you know, we don't measure it as if each person is a sort of quantifiable metric. We measure it on depth rather than width. And if you redefine success from numerical metrics to depth of relationship, then and faithfulness to what we feel called to do, then we're very successful. Sarah once asked somebody who was actually a donor to our MPO called Tree of Life, and they said, so what's your success rate? And she said, well, here's the thing. We don't feel called to get people clean as if we're a rehab, because we're not. We feel called to open our home and welcome young men who need love and belonging. And she said, we've done that for each person who's come through our door. So in that sense, we're 100% successful. And I remember thinking, wow, she had owned that conversation. And so I think there's an emotional sustainability where you watch people relapse and you watch them make disastrous choices again and again. And you realize that relapse is part of recovery, and that the, quote, successes don't validate what we're doing as much as the relapses don't destroy what we're doing. But I mean, you know, to answer your question directly, there's a young man who I mentioned that I moved into a house in the center of hard living gang territory 10 years ago. He's now 7 years clean off heroin, is married, living in a suburb out of Mannenberg, and his father to a son, and is you know, a young professional. So that's an example of one guy. Now, there are other guys whose stories are still being written, who are living with us, who are 3 years clean out of the Stupor Boys, another who started a gang called the Rude Boys. And all of these different people are on a journey. You know, it's like, ask us in 10 years, and some of the success, quote, stories might have relapsed by then, or others who we might be feeling completely hopeless about now may have come good. And so it really is this whole thing of, there's a quote, I think, by an indigenous Aborigine female community organizer who said, look, if you've come here to help, don't bother. But if somehow your freedom is bound up in mine, then let's walk together. And what Sarah and I are finding as white privileged people, as we seek to give away power and share life and belonging with those that the world says belongs in jail, we're beginning to see that our freedom is entwined in a really beautiful journey of co-liberation.
You know, I listen to you, and I've got a smile on my face at the moment. you've challenged so many assumptions that people have, right? And it's just wonderful that you're doing this. And I also think about the way people, you know, involved in religion insert themselves in communities. And I won't mention which church, but I spent a lot of time. But you look at the opulence that exists in between the four walls of this church,
yeah,
versus what that juxtaposition of absolute abject poverty and beautiful marble inside this church and paintings and lovely food on a regular basis. And as a young person, I struggle to reconcile the two.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when you consider that Jesus was born in occupied territory, a political refugee, to an unmarried teenage mother, that he was from a notorious community and had brown skin, you wonder where the direction of many of these churches have, you know, how they've got to where they've got to. You know, we obviously wouldn't judge people, and, you know, have got to be careful to maintain unity and all of that. But I think for us, as you say, the we're trying to live in such a way that if God didn't exist, our life wouldn't make sense. And we're trying to live our life as a sign that another world is possible, where lots of people are asking for solutions. Give us the solution to gangsterism and drugs. We're saying, whoa, we don't have a solution, but we can live our lives one by one as signs that another reality is possible. And that's what Jesus called the kingdom of God. And I think it's the most beautiful, infectious, enthralling, captivating life that any human could live. So it's our joy to do it.
I don't wear any hats, but I'll take mine off to you. I just think it's wonderful. It's inspirational listening to you. And do you ever connect to people who can then open up other doors? So you might have someone who was in a gang, misses his or her mother, really wants to get out of it, but is also scared that if they stay within the community, something could happen to them. Do you link up with other organizations that can open up other realities for young people at all?
Yeah, we're looking at vocational training as a really, you know, social enterprise and vocational training as a great means to, you know, help people sustain that that sort of break from gangs and drugs. And that's something we're currently working on. We've got, for example, a small woodwork social enterprise that we're trying to get off the ground. We connect with other NGOs for, you know, various parts of our daily program. But increasingly, yeah, we're hoping to connect with more organizations that would offer employment to guys. Because, I mean, at the moment, employment's a difficult thing anyway. But we've, you know, thinking directly right now, we've got three young men who we could vouch for who are brilliant, who have left gangs and drugs behind and are looking for work to support families and themselves. And so we're trying to find partners who would consider employing or even giving apprenticeships to young guys and get over that stigma of, oh, but he used to be a gangster, you know? Yep. So that's definitely something we're working on and would be keen to hear from anyone who is open to that.
And we'd be happy to connect them to you. Now, finally, we're going to be going into our news headlines pretty soon, but what about your family at home in the UK? When they heard that this is what you're doing, this is what your life is, what was that response like?
that's a whole other interview right there. No, people are very supportive. I think various members of my family who wouldn't necessarily share my faith struggle to understand the sort of core motivation behind what we do. A couple of years ago, Sarah and I studied master's degrees in London. She did war studies and I did political theology. And I think our families then thought, okay, great, now they're finally going to get a proper job. But you know, if you study what Sarah studied, which is the reintegration of child soldiers back into communities, And what I studied was, you know, incarnational theology in post-apartheid South Africa. All lots of long words, but really it's living amongst poor communities, and hers was helping gangsters reintegrate. So, of course, you want to use all of that in to inform your work. So for us, downward mobility is really the order of the day, not upward. And, yeah, family members 11 years in are beginning to see that there is something to be said for it, and it's not just a phase.
You know, you living your life with purpose. You wake up and there's a reason to breathe. You're fulfilled. I just think it's a phenomenal space. I don't know whether I would move back to Mandenberg, to be honest with you. I don't think, I mean, if one looks at my space where I am in, you know, I'm one of those people, yes, I live in a lovely area. I'm happy to assist. Would I live there to do it? It takes a special type of person with a special type of faith to be able to do that. So very inspirational. Great chatting to you. I'm asking people to go to your website as well, which is, was it peteportal.com or .co.za?
There's peteportal.com where people can read the book, the account, yes, the experiences of the last 10 years. And then there's treeoflife.org.za, which is our church community, which has videos and news and all sorts of info about the work we do in Mandenberg.
Brilliant. Well, Pete, thank you for inspiring, sir. And more than that, thank you for doing. Really appreciate chatting to you. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for the chat, Kino.
Absolute pleasure. That is Pete Portal, author and also community worker in Mandenberg.